In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
It's a fight to divide us. It's a war, really, to keep us angry and attacking one another. There is nothing the elitist rulers hate more than a united country, that people get along, that all those supposed barriers that divide us are nothing more than walls imposed on us from above. Look at the election of Donald Trump, how divided the country became. The leftist media accused him of everything, even being a racist. A guy who had won numerous awards and admiration from the black community for his work in support of black Americans was now labeled a racist. But Trump was elected, and riots broke out, paid for, organized riots, in an attempt to show you how much America really hated Trump. Even the notion of Make America Great Again was deemed divisive. The media is pushing now the idea that making America great again and even just wearing that red hats is racist. Are you kidding? Americans working to make America great. This is unifying, not divisive. Why would any American not want to make America great? Who wouldn't want to make America great again? Easy. Those elitist rulers, the deep staters, the big governmenters, the New World Order types who hate borders and nations and people so much that they would rather see America destroyed then made great. Perhaps the biggest news this week is that Attorney General Barr told a congressional committee that, yes, he thinks the FBI and elements of our own government did spy on the Trump campaign. It's probably not a coincidence that the very next day that UK officials swooped in and physically dragged Julian Assange of WikiLeaks out of the Ecuadorian embassy in London. To me, it says the deep state is in panic. They fear us uniting. Let's review. 3 weeks ago, the Mueller report came out with no evidence Trump colluded with the Russians. Just like that, the big lie of the left disappeared overnight. As a result, more and more commentators and congressmen and senators began to make noises about investigating the investigators, and that the leaders of this attempted coup, and that's exactly what it was, an attempted coup, needed to be brought to justice. And they are exactly right. No one will ever trust elections or the Justice Department or the justice system unless and until whoever it was that pushed this fakest of fake news, this conspiracy, this coup attempt, are punished for their crimes. This week is the beginning of the panic. What the deep state knew for so long, that Trump never colluded with the Russians, now everybody knows. Their lie is exposed. They've lost the narrative. Their ability to keep America divided is slipping from their grasp. And they personally are about to be exposed, along with their efforts to divide America, to destroy her from within, make you think Trump didn't win without collusion, make you think things like the Electoral College is unfair. We're now seeing their efforts to target Americans, efforts to make us lose faith in our systems. And in that, the deep state is winning. I don't have faith in government. Do you? Not what America has become. I have faith in America and what we can be great again. I'd like to welcome now George Papadopoulos, one of the targets of that deep state, and that's the name of his brand new book, Deep State Target, How I Got Caught in the Crosshairs of the Plot to Bring Down President Trump. George, it is great to finally talk to you.
Oh, it's great to be on. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. We've been looking forward to this for quite a while now. So let's sort of start with a recap, especially for people that maybe aren't quite familiar with your story. There's been a lot of false information out of there, and certainly as this story unfolded over the course of a year, there was a lot of back and forth and tons of fake news. So let me see if I can describe what happened to you in a nutshell. You joined the Trump presidential campaign team, and you were then set up by members of the FBI as an effort to create the legal means to open an FBI investigation into the Trump campaign. This happened when an FBI asset approached you and told you that the Russians had Hillary's emails, and then later you then mentioned what was told to you by that FBI contact, but you just happened to mention it to someone else who was also working with the FBI. So basically, they planted the evidence on you. Is that correct, or did we miss something?
That's absolutely correct, and it just goes to show you, and first of all, the whole Alexander Downer, Australian diplomat, regarding that person that you mentioned that I apparently told this information to is a lie. I never told him this information, so he lied about our meeting, and I explained even in my congressional testimony, which is public now, that members of Congress themselves know that that was a fake story and that this guy was basically an FBI asset sent to make contact with me and dirty me up. It was a similar situation with other spies that were sent my way and even Mike Flynn's way. One thing that Mike Flynn and I had in common, besides that we're working on the transition together, was that we had the same FBI-CIA asset who was sent to basically dirty us up and create this fake pretext to investigate not only us, but the entire campaign. So while the story is a lot different than most of your listeners, or probably even you guys, have heard or read over the last 2 years by the New York Times or some of these other outlets, but that's actually what my book, Deep State Target, is all about. It's all about basically exposing the truth, why I was targeted, and corroborating my statements by a congressional testimony that I gave that's been recently released.
So in terms of that first person that approached you with the 30,000 emails, that part is correct. Am I hearing that correctly?
Yes. So I did have a man who, by the way, was introduced to me. One thing that the New York Times and Mueller and the FBI have left out about this story is that the man who told me this information, named Joseph Mifsud, was actually introduced to me by an FBI intermediary in London named Arvinder Sambe. But of course, that doesn't fit the narrative because they had to create this fake story that he was a Russian agent when he really wasn't. So over lunch one day in London, as I'm having one of my probably two dozen lunches or meetings I was having with various diplomats and officials as a member of the foreign policy team, this man tells me, "Hey, George, you know that the Russians have Hillary Clinton's emails?" So he basically drops this unsolicited information in my lap that I never asked for. I had no idea he was going to actually tell me this information when I sat with him, and I do nothing with this information because I just found it to be very bizarre. What I did do with this information was I told the FBI voluntarily in January of 2017, there was a strange guy from Malta in London who told me that the Russians might have Hillary's emails. I don't know too much about him, but you should look into him. When I told this to the FBI, it's as if I told them that the sky is blue and 2 + 2 = 4. They were not shocked. It didn't even make an impression on them because later on I find out that he was working for them, basically entrapping me and using that as a pretext to get FISA warrants along with the dossier and along with the fake testimony of Christopher Steele, who hated Trump, Alexander Downer, who hated Trump, and Joseph Mifsud, who hated Trump, to basically fabricate an entire investigation and launch what later became the Russia probe.
Wow. So just to back up a little bit, you said you voluntarily told the FBI that information in January 2017. At that point, were they investigating you at all, or did you just contact them and said, "Hey, you need to look into this guy"?
So the FBI, and this is something that's new information because, of course, I haven't been able to talk. I had a FISA warrant on me that dated back to 2015 and during my time on the campaign because the Obama administration put me under the microscope for my dealings in the energy business in the Middle East, including in Israel and Egypt. Something that many people don't understand is I was actually hired to join both the Trump and Ben Carson campaigns because they understood that I had incredibly high-level contacts in the Middle East to the extent where I introduced Donald Trump to the Egyptian president during the UN General Assembly, and I was actually meeting with various presidents of the Middle East during the transition team when I was working with Mike Flynn. So these are the facts, and they've been misrepresented, and they frame me as some sort of Russian intermediary that I was never, because the Obama administration and the FBI had been targeting me for my Middle East ties, which, of course, when you're targeting an individual for his ties to Israel, it's very politically sensitive. And that's actually what my entire case really is about. But in order to deflect from that, I got myself involved in this situation, which I had nothing to do with. And it's quite an incredible story. And I wish it wasn't true, but, you know, in this situation, truth is much stranger than fiction.
Yeah, that's for sure. Let's go and take a break there. Lots more to ask of George Papadopoulos. He's the author of Deep State Target, How I Got Caught in the Crosshairs of the Plot to Bring Down President Trump. And we'll link that up on iSpyRadio.com. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're talking to George Papadopoulos. He is the author of Deep State Target, How I Got Caught in the Crosshairs of the Plot to Bring Down President Trump. And boy, after that first segment there, everything that you have told us is vastly different than what we've been hearing in the press over the course of the last year and a half or so, or 2 years. What really stands out to me is just this utter entrapment that you went through. I mean, it's like the FBI is standing there. You're just some guy on the corner, essentially. And yeah. They say, here, hold my gun. And then they point to you and say, oh, my God, he's got the gun the bank robbers used. I mean, that's essentially what they're doing, is where they fed you this information just out of the blue. And then they accuse you of then leaking that to somebody else. And as we learned in that last segment, that's totally a lie. So going back to that meeting, though, with Professor Mifsud, when he dropped that about the 30,000 emails, what was the context of that conversation? Did he just suddenly drop that out of nowhere, or had you guys been talking about it, Hillary? And talk to us a little bit about that.
Okay. So remember, as I explained, I was introduced to this person by an FBI intermediary in London named Arvinder Sambe. I want the listeners to do a little homework and Google this person when they're done listening to this. Arvinder Sambe was one of the top legal attachés for the FBI in the UK, and she had a working relationship going back to 9/11 with Bob Mueller, okay?
Hmm.
She was a director at the company I worked for in London at the time that I joined the Trump campaign. In this company, it's called the London Center for International Law Practice. This company, the last thing it has involved with it are Russians. It's completely, all the directors are filled with ex-Western diplomats, ex-Western intelligence types, young, likely intelligence operatives from the U.S., from Europe. She was a director there. And when I tell her, and leading up to my work on the Trump and Ben Carson campaigns, I had been working for 5 years at the Hudson Institute in Washington, D.C., with personalities like Douglas Feith, who was the number three at the Pentagon under the Bush administration, Scooter Libby, who was obviously the vice, he was chief of staff of Dick Cheney, and others. So this was my world, okay? I was familiar with this, and the last thing I was doing in these circles was promoting Russian interests. Now, what happened is this. I notified this organization that I just told you about. I'm sorry, but I'm leaving, and I'm going to join the Trump campaign. And all of a sudden, they became very hostile. And they tell me, well, you shouldn't leave. You shouldn't do that. He's a pariah. He's a danger to the world. And you're making a mass mistake. And I just found it very odd that they would be talking to me like this. So anyways, this woman, Arvinder Sambe, brings me into her office, who she was a director at the time. I'm not sure what she's doing now. And she tells me, before you go back to the U.S., you should go to Rome and you need to meet some high-level officials who are going to help you with the Trump campaign. And I said, okay, that's interesting. I go to Rome at a university called Link Campus, okay? And anybody who wants to Google this place can do it. And you'll probably see an article in the Washington Post by David Ignatius, who characterizes this school as a CIA FBI training school in Rome, okay? And that's where I meet Joseph Mifsud. So I want to give the readers context of how and what I was up to with this person. So I meet him at a training school for the CIA in Rome, and he tells me that he's going to be a good help for me and introduce me and the campaign to both European diplomats and to the Russians. And I say, okay, that's very interesting. Let me just hear more about what you have to say. Then we go back to London the next week, and he introduces me to this young lady who he falsely characterizes as the niece of Vladimir Putin, which is very bizarre, okay?
And this, so is, this one, is Sambe.
No, this is Joseph Mifsud at this point.
Look, I meant the woman that he was introducing you to.
No.
Oh, so this is somebody different, okay.
After I meet him in Rome, he takes a liking to me. I find him interesting, and he says, I'm going back to London next week, and let's catch up. because, and I said, that's fine. And he emails me and he says, I have somebody very important for you to meet. And I said, who? The niece of Vladimir Putin. Okay, which is a complete scam. Vladimir Putin has no siblings. So I go back to the company, this London Center group, and I ask them, is this real? Is this legitimate or what? And they say, yes, yes, you need to go meet with Joseph and the niece. So basically, I get to this meeting in London a week after I meet Joseph in Rome, and he's introducing me to a woman he calls the niece of Vladimir Putin, who she never was, and we later find out that she was part of a Western intelligence operation against me herself, okay, wow. To make it look like I was talking to Russians. Then after that meeting, let's say a week or two later, out of the blue, having lunch with me, he sits down at a five-star hotel with me in London, unsolicited, and tells me, hey, George, you know that the Russians have Hillary's emails. In this very bizarre conspiratorial manner, where he leans over to me in front of a public dining hall at a hotel and says this to me, and I do nothing with this information, okay? I do absolutely nothing with this information, but the FBI and the British intelligence who are working with the FBI, basically using this guy to target me, knew what he told me, and that's when they had me meet Alexander Downer, and he could lie about the meeting because they had proof that I already had that information in my mind, as you perfectly explained earlier. So these are the facts, okay? And right now, one of the key questions that everyone is asking and looking into, including the president himself, who last Tuesday tweeted a segment from Fox and Friends discussing Joseph Mifsud, is who was running Joseph Mifsud, where is he, and did the Obama administration know what he was up to? And if the Obama administration knew that Joseph Mifsud was a Western intelligence operative targeting me and the campaign from the get-go, then they're probably going to be in a world of trouble themselves. You might actually see criminal indictments for conspiracy on their end. And quite frankly, we might already start seeing that by means of the Devin Nunes criminal complaints that he's going to be referring to the DOJ likely in the next couple of weeks or so.
Wow. Wow. This is just absolutely stunning. Absolutely stunning. Let's go and take a break there. We'll wrap things up with George Papadopoulos after this. And welcome back into our final segment with George Papadopoulos. His new book is Deep State Target, How I Got Caught in the Crosshairs of the Plot to Bring Down President Trump. And if you've missed the first two segments, we'll have this up on iSpyRadio.com. You can catch all that. But oh my word, I talk about Deep State Target. This is just astonishing to hear that our own government was going to this depth to set up one of our own citizens. I mean, that I think is really shocking. So you mentioned in that last segment there, in terms of the big questions right now, in terms of like, where is this Mifsud? Who was his runner and all the rest? Do you have any indication at all who was behind him?
I have very credible information that he's actually being held in Italy right now. Don't forget, I met him at a spy school in Rome. He's very well connected to both British intelligence, the CIA, and Italian intelligence. He's an Italian citizen. And what I did was a couple weeks ago, I gave an interview to Sky Italia, which is the biggest news channel in all of Italy, where basically the reporter who disclosed this information to me that Mifsud's in Italy asked me, what's your message to the Italian prime minister? And my message to the Italian prime minister was you need to reveal to the extent that the Italian government was involved in conspiring with the FBI and the Obama administration to target us, and to give up Mifsud and hand him over to not necessarily be, indicted, but for him to be under questioning by congressional investigators, so we could understand, because Congress obviously has oversight of the FBI and the CIA, to understand why Mifsud was reaching out to me and who was handling him. And right now, if those sources are indeed correct, that he's openly living in a NATO country, Italy, and his own lawyer, by the way, this man named Stephen Rowe, which everybody could also look up, is going public and saying that his client was working with the FBI, It's going to cause a big friction right now with the Italians and maybe the British who were handling him. But that's the information I have right now, and it's very credible.
Within the FBI, do you have any idea who was running him there? Any specific intelligence?
Yes. There's an agent by the name of Michael Gaeta, who was the FBI's liaison in Rome, who was handling Christopher Steele. He was meeting with Bruce Orr in Rome, and there's now speculation that part of what the Bruce Orr 302s are going to disclose is that MIPSUD was also being handled by Michael Gaeta in Rome. So this is a big bombshell that's going to be coming out most likely when the president decides to declassify all this material.
In terms of that declassification, why do you think he's taking so long? Because there's a lot of information that people have been very hungry for, and I think a lot of us, myself included, are a little mystified as to why that hasn't been released yet. Do you think it's just a matter of these other pieces, these other dominoes had to fall first?
Two reasons in my estimation. One, first of all, the name George Papadopoulos was falsely characterized to the world for 2 years, and it's likely that the British and the Italians and the Australians who were targeting me were lying to the administration about me and basically telling them that we had to do what we had to do, okay? But and that's one. And now, obviously, Trump understands they were mocking him and fooling him. That's why he decided to declassify the documents last week on Hannity's show. And secondly, what happened was, obviously, there was an investigation ongoing. And if Trump decided to have declassified material, it could have been seen as obstruction. So that's why he was biding his time until about 5 days after the Mueller report was submitted. And he went on the Sean Hannity show. And he basically told the world, I'm going to declassify the documents now. So that's where we are now.
Well, in terms of going forward here, you mentioned this Michael Gaeta guy, and it's really not clear just yet how far up the ladder this goes. You did mention that this may go all the way up to Obama. What should happen to these people, in your estimation?
Well, first of all, the biggest thing that could happen is for their reputation to be destroyed, okay? Because they were going around on TV calling themselves heroes, investigating Russia, conspiracy, Russian agents, when they knew full well, just like Adam Schiff and all these people knew, that it was a lie. Okay, so first of all, I want them to be viewed as liars and as dishonest, basically traitors against America. That's one. And two, should there have been a real conspiracy, which it looks like there was, to lie to the FISA court and obtain warrants against us, then these people really need to be indicted. And I think the first step towards that is what Devin Nunes has done. And he might be doing it next week, is referring certain members of the FBI and DOJ and Obama administration for criminal referrals. That's what I think is going to happen. Now, you ask me how far up does it go? Well, for there to be FISA warrants, that means that the attorney general had to sign off on it. So that implicates Holder and Sally Yates. If CIA assets and FBI assets were being weaponized against us, that means John Brennan and Comey were directly involved. And by just simply looking at the text messages between Peter Strzok and Lisa Page, we now know that that Obama wanted to know everything. So it's likely that Obama and his team were leading it by design. So we'll see how far, but that's my prediction, and I'm pretty sure I'm right.
Well, the extent to which you were set up is just astronomical. We've talked with John Kiriakou, who went through some pretty similar things in terms of being set up, being fed information, and then they were actually trying to get him to commit treason by accepting bribes. But it very similar circumstances. But what gets me about your situation is not only the extent to which they went, but the fact that they were actually going after the president of the United States. And I think this is something that ought to get the Democrats involved, too, because if it happened to Trump, what would stop, say, some Republican members of the FBI going after the next Democrat presidential candidate? Why do you think the Democrats don't seem to care about this? I mean, to me, this is the scandal of the century.
I think that they do care. But right now, because they have egg on their face regarding this investigation and how wrong they were, they have to kind of beat the dead horse a little bit. But I do believe that they're going to acquiesce a bit in terms of, you know, allowing the president to declassify material. Because as you said, no one wants this to happen to them. And can you imagine being Kamala Harris's campaign or Bernie Sanders's campaign and having the president of the United States weaponize the CIA, the FBI, the UK, Australia, and Italy and other countries to spy on them? It'd be it'd be horrifying. Yeah. I would not stand for it. And I worked for Trump, let alone Americans. So I agree with you, and I think that's what's going to happen. I think they're going to acquiesce a bit now that the Mueller report is out, and we're just going to have to heal as a nation once the extent of the corruption is revealed.
Yeah, and the thing is, in order to heal, they really do need to get on board. They really do need to be part of this investigation, because I think that is something that everybody ought to be able to agree on, is that this sort of thing should never, ever happen again. George Papadopoulos, his book, Deep State Target, How I Got Caught in the Crosshairs of the Plot to Bring Down President Trump. George, thank you so much. We would love to talk to you again sometime in the near future.
Thank you very much for having me.
And welcome back. I'd like to welcome Burgess Owens. He's a former NFL player, first with the Jets and then with the Raiders, where he won the Super Bowl with them. He is the author of Liberalism, or How to Turn Good Men into Whiners, Weenies, and Wimps. His latest book is Why I Stand, From Freedom to the Killing Field of Socialism. Burgess, it is always fun to talk to you.
Mark, same here, and I'm looking forward to the topics we'll be going through. So for those listening in, stay tuned. We're going to go through some really good stuff.
That's right. This is going to be good stuff here. So I'd really like to start with Candace Owens. She absolutely did a scorched earth policy there on Ted Lieu and Nadler at a congressional hearing. Ted Lieu was trying to embarrass her, and he played an edited clip which left out some of the main points there, but it tried to make out like she liked Hitler and thought he was a great nationalist. And then in her response to him, she said, Ted Lieu must think blacks are stupid because he must think blacks won't go and look for the full clip, at which point Nadler then slammed his gavel and demanded that she apologize for calling Ted Lieu stupid. So did you see that clip? What did you think of that?
I did see it, and it's so refreshing to hear Americans, I should say Black Americans particularly, like Candace, who are actually speaking the truth. And what you have here is we have to really understand what we're up against. These are elitists, yes, who are cowards and bullies, and they're not used to someone like Candace speaking back and having the power, being in power to speak up. So they have nothing they could say once that was made very obvious. And she made such a good point. For those of us who understand how these guys work, the fact that this guy Lieu would put that out there in the public forum did not give her a chance to respond to that at all during his time. She had to come back to somebody else's time to respond to what this attack he had. So they're all about trying to develop a narrative, and Candace did a great job explaining it and getting back to the fact that at the bottom line, we have issues that are impacting the Black American population, like education and lack of jobs and lack of opportunities. And what they're trying to do continually is bring up supremacists, white supremacists, and racism as our biggest issue, when it's not, is democratic policies. And I just love hearing it. And now we're talking about it. That's what it's all about, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was pretty clear that people who saw that clip, and we'll make sure that we link that up on iSpyRadio.com on today's show page, it's pretty clear that the Democrats clearly had her there just as a prop upon which to project their talking points. I mean, they weren't there to listen, since Nadler himself clearly wasn't listening. He thought she had called Lieu stupid rather than what she had actually said, which was that Lieu thinks blacks are stupid. I mean, how telling is that, really, that the moment that she starts talking, Nadler essentially tunes her out and stops listening, only to be awakened from his slumber by the use of the word stupid?
Yeah, well, what's even more telling is this. Candace mentioned a few facts, and these are things that's been going on for quite a while. And you and I, we've talked about this over the years. You know, we have 83% of the Black teen boys in the state of in our country not having jobs for the last 8 years. You have 75% of those Black boys in the state of California, Democratic in control, who cannot read and write. None of that has been discussed, and I can promise you none of those things will be discussed as a forum for the Democrats, because they could care less about the plight of the Black race or the brown race or the Indian race. They're all about using, abusing, and discarding. They do that so well because it's all about power. Yes. So I'm excited about people like Candace getting this voice, and Americans tuning in that are sometimes maybe moderate and maybe liberal, but they just never knew that this was going on. And if they really care about our country and our people, they're going to tune in and try to figure out what's going on now.
It was really shocking, actually. I shouldn't say shocking. It was really interesting to watch their expressions when she suddenly, you know, came back at them. They are not used to an articulate Republican conservative being able to come back at them like that. And she just nailed them. I mean, it was total scorched earth.
No, I'm going to tell you what they're used to. These guys, these elitists, are used to other black elitists that kowtow, that submit, that are very, very submissive, and they do exactly what they're told to do. They're not used to independent, strong black people, in particular women. So no, they have no idea how to come back on this, in particular when this truth is being involved with here. So they understand that what they should be understanding, and that's what I'm excited about, is that black Americans are leaving the plantation, and they're going to have a lot more pushback. We're not going to be as compliant. We're not going to be as loyal. We're going to ask those hard questions and demand that they, as our servants, come to the plate and take care of business.
Yes. Well, and then what was interesting, too, is that in the wake of that, it was a hugely popular clip. It was making its rounds all across Facebook and Twitter and YouTube as well. And then, surprisingly, Google and its subsidiary YouTube suddenly blocked her videos, putting them all in restricted mode. I guess black people aren't stupid after all if Google had to hide it from them.
Well, that's how they keep blacks stupid. this is interesting because I have my family. I have really intelligent, good family members who, in any other area, they're very smart, very intuitive. But what happens is all about indoctrination, Mark.
Yes.
What we're seeing with the left is exactly what the Nazis did in the 1930s. They have propagandized. They put out a certain message over and over again until that message of lies becomes truth. And if you put in a community very small place where all they're doing is hearing the leftist message, then of course they're going to believe that. What's happening is that people like Candace is breaking that open, and Google and Twitter, those guys can't stand it. They're trying to control it, but unfortunately for them, we're in a whole new world now where we have access, and other than going to be in MSNBC and CNN, so it's going to be a good thing for us.
Yeah, absolutely. Well. In case people aren't aware what restricted mode means, it means the video is being censored from users that have enabled or their provider has enabled the website's restricted mode feature, which is typically includes things like libraries and schools and public institutions, and certainly any younger viewers. And that restricted mode is normally used to block videos that have been deemed inappropriate, such as pornography or violence. You know, it's pretty clear that they are absolutely terrified of Candace Owens and other voices from within the black community that are conservatives and well-spoken. So how long before...
Can I say this, Mark, real quick?
Well, sure. I'm just going to ask you how long before you get blocked.
Understand what these guys are all about. They are the worst of our country.
Yes.
When I say use, abuse, and discard, our country is built on service, on empathy, on love for each other, on uplifting. We have a very dark ideology that is all about hatred,
yes,
destruction, and using discarding people for their own power. These people are willingly allowing our kids to grow up ignorant and dumb and uneducated so they can in the future have power. Imagine this. 75% of black boys in the state of California cannot read and write. And we know in 2019, that means you're going directly to jail, directly to drugs or some other negative impact because you have no hope. You have no way of educating yourself or articulating yourself. And the most important thing, it also allows you to be propagandized by people who put something over radio, TV all the time. So this is a very evil ideology, to say the least. You have to understand that.
It absolutely is. And as far as socialism, using and discarding, we'll talk about that later. Coming up, the whole reparations thing, is it for real? What does the black community think about all that? Stay with us. And welcome back. We're talking to Burgess Owens. He's a former NFL player and author. His latest book is Why I Stand, From Freedom to the Killing Fields of Socialism. You've seen him on Fox News, and he is a frequent guest here on I Spy, someone we've come to admire and respect. Burgess, you know, we still need to get you an As Seen on I Spy Radio t-shirt for when you're on Sean Hannity.
Of course, I'll wear it proudly, buddy, for sure. Just ship it. Ship it. Yeah. We'll get it done.
There we go. Hey, you know, we were talking to George Papadopoulos in the last first half of the show. And you were talking about this dividing and keeping blacks down, but really a lot of the indoctrination and stuff. And it was really interesting. I had come across an article that really talked specifically about that, and this, and well, and it ties right into to Twitter and Facebook censoring people, and the elitists really do fear when the people are able to talk freely to one another.
Yes. Yeah. Well, there's a couple things that they are adamantly against. That is, one is harmony. The greatest threat to these people is that if we get along.
Yes.
If we start to look at each other from inside out and not outside in, and start appreciating and serving, that is totally against their way of thinking. So, communication, education. Matter of fact, it was Thomas Jefferson said, "Freedom of the ignorant and free can never be." To paraphrase. So it is. It's been at the very foundation of our country that our freedom, our love for each other, our growth, our American way is based on education. So if you wonder why they focus on like stealth little termites, they get into our education system and they begin to cut off the freedom of speech, cut off the access to other ideas, because they understand that's the greatest threat to the ideology of atheism, Marxism, and socialism.
Yes,
what strengthens us weakens them, and that's right. The fight we're up against at this point.
That's right. And, you know, we always have so much more in common than we do that divides
us. Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, speaking of divisions, I'd like to talk about this reparations thing. A friend of ours wrote on Facebook that I'd like to point out that reparations that these politicians want have already been paid for the last 55 years in the form of minority businesses, set-asides, preferential government contract bidding, scholarships, and lowered college admission requirements based on their race, a Black History Month, MLK birthday holidays, streets named after various Black leaders and a Black president of the United States, their own race-based caucus in Congress, preferential hiring for city, state, and federal jobs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So what are your thoughts on reparations?
Well, first of all, it'll never be enough for the leftists. At the core of reparation, at the core of liberalism is racism.
Yes.
When you can actually convince a race that one race is superior, and that's what white privilege is all about. This is something, by the way, I grew up in the 1960s, so I recognize what racism really looks like. When you can convince a race that because of their color, they have more privilege, they have more superiority, they are smarter and more intelligent. And keep this in mind. Think about the way reparation works out. It's never dealing with sports and entertainment. They never ask for reparation for what they have not done in sports and entertainment, because it's always been the leftist who's looked at the Black race as not an intelligent race, but one is really good at singing, dancing, and entertaining. That's their focus. It always has been. And at the end of the day, when you think about what our country's done, not only have we the people as a culture fought to make sure that everyone has the rights to be successful. That's why 300,000 Union soldiers died in the Civil War. That's why we have a white president who died at the end of the Civil War to make sure that things like slavery came to an end. And the other part of this process is you have to convince Black people that they've been doing nothing but being a hapless, oppressed race all these years. You have to hide the fact that in 1901, there was a Black college called Tuskegee University that led that was producing more self-made millionaires than Harvard, Yale, and Princeton combined. You have to hide the fact that during the 1900s, from 1900 up to 1970, it was a Black race that led our country in terms of growth of middle class, the commitment of men to marriage, the percentage of entrepreneurs, the percentage of men matriculating in college. All those things were happening in my middle class community, of which 50% of Blacks were middle class. You have to hide that for this idea of reparation to even come up as a conversation, because people need to see the Black race as a hapless and hopeless and oppressed race for them to say what they owe us something. To me, it's an insult, a great insult, because it demeans the legacy of my parents and all those in the past who paid the price to be respected, not pitied.
That's right. And it, like you say, it does get down to when is enough is enough. You know, I am actually all for reparations, just in a slightly different way, and here's why. There were zero Republican slave owners. Republicans are the ones who bled and died to free slaves in the Civil War. Slave owners were, by and large, Democrats. Democrats fought to keep slaves enslaved. Therefore, I am all for Democrats paying reparations to Republicans. I think every registered Democrat ought to cut a check to a Republican.
I had the same conversation about 2 weeks ago to someone, and you hit it on the nail, Mark.
That's right.
If we want to talk about reparations, if you want to go that route, then let's point to the people who the party who has been at the head of producing the most misery. That's the Democratic Party.
That's
I'll say this as an American who's experienced the American dream, who has a great-great-grandfather, Silas Burgess, who came here in the belly of a slave ship, who died as a property owner of 102 acres, paid off in 2 years, owner of founder of a first high school, and elementary, the founder of the first church in that area, pillar of his community. That was in the late 1800s. So we don't need to be talking about what we have not been able to accomplish and overcome. Mm-hmm. We should be proud of our country, proud of what we've done together, and in that regard, reparation has no place to even begin a conversation, to say the least.
No, absolutely not. Plus, I don't know how you could possibly hold great-great-grandchildren responsible for something that they never personally did. Exactly. But what have you been hearing from within the Black community about these Democrat candidates thinking reparations would be good? A lot of it, to me anyway, sounds like it's beginning to sound like a free Obama phone syndrome. But what are you hearing? Is this getting any traction within Blacks, or are they just using them for props again?
Well, what's happening is that the thing about the left, it's a party of people of no vision. They do what they do habitually. What they don't recognize is that Black Americans are waking up, just like Hispanic Americans. The things that they are now pushing for and prompting up is something that could have worked out maybe 10, 15 years ago. But we're not a country now. You know, we want answers, we want solutions.
That's right.
We've gone through the Obama time where we expected hope and change. It didn't happen. So we have more Black Americans who are walking away from the Democratic Party. And as they do so, their messaging is so out of touch that we're walking away faster than ever before. So you hear people like Candace, but Candace is just a tip of iceberg. There are many Americans across this country, Black Americans, just normal Black Americans are saying, you know what, I'm finally getting it. And it's kind of neat to see that. Matter of fact, there's a young man, he has a walk away campaign.
Yes.
I wish I could think of his name. Brandon. Yep. Anyway, take a look at that. There's a video of 20 Black Americans that are speaking about why they're walking away. And that's what's going on right now.
Absolutely. I think people all over are waking up. It gets back to what we said earlier about people having good information and communication with one another. All right, let's go and take a break. We'll wrap things up with Burgess Owens. After this, when we come back, the gangland murder of a Black man who was escaping the Democrat plantation. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're wrapping things up with Burgess Owens, a former NFL player and Super Bowl winner with the Oakland Raiders. His latest book is Why I Stand, From Freedom to the Killing Fields of Socialism. And killing fields, you know, we talked earlier about using and discarding. Have you noticed how many liberal and socialist policies involve killing people? You got abortion, assisted suicide, gun-free zones, so the only people who are armed are the criminals. You know, I guess people would be a lot easier to control as if you're a socialist, if there just weren't so many of them. And now, of course, we've got infanticide. And Burgess, speaking of the infanticide stuff, you know, you got Planned Parenthood. It's started by Margaret Sanger, who was a huge racist. She wanted to have Blacks abort their children. Nowadays, 79% of Planned Parenthood clinics are within Black neighborhoods. I'm sure that's not a coincidence. Do you think this push by Virginia Democrats to allow for infanticide, is that starting to wake up Black Americans to the horrors of abortion?
I think what's happened very simply is that progressives were going so well for so long that they kind of thought they can sprint to the finish line. Mm. So we're now hearing things that America's not ready to hear. We're not ready to have our babies born, put them on the table, and decide if they're going to live or die or not. That's not happening. And what we have to understand is that it is about an ideology. I mean, there are people involved, so we can change people's minds sometimes, but there's an evil that comes with Marxism, socialism, and atheism. It's everything that's anti-God, anti-good, anti-life, and anti-hope.
Yes.
So if you understand that, every policy that these guys have will always be the death of hope, faith, and life. So don't be surprised. It's just what we're dealing with, and it's the fight that we'll have throughout our country. We have to recognize that, again, it is this fight of good and evil.
Yes.
And go from there.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'd like to talk to you about Nipsey Hussle. And for those who haven't read the story, he's a rapper, and he was turning his back on the gang community, trying to make his life and other lives better. He was in the process of reaching out to the police community to start problem solving the issues around gangs when in broad daylight he was gunned down by a gang member. You know, we've been talking about the fight that the Black community has to break away from attempts to keep them down in the ghettos. And then this happens to someone who is trying to make improvements to the Black community. He had something like 20,000 people show up for his memorial service. Do you have any thoughts about this? I mean, did you know about him and the work he'd been doing?
I did not. I'm not really much been into the rapping environment. I've heard a lot about him since then. He really represents what I think for this community, for these kids particularly, the at-risk, those that have been kind of thrown away as trash. He was kind of the Martin Luther King potential because he was listening. He was serving. He was doing more than just talking. And he was actually investing back in his community to give these kids hope. And it's sad again to see that evil shows up. So whether it be this young person who obviously has some strong, bad, evil issues to come up and just kill someone like this, or it's the Democratic Party that's a little bit more subtle and they use policies that over years do the same thing, we're up against this issue. And I do believe this, that because of this the light that this young man brought to this community, these people now that are actually there is a they stopped fighting. There was a truce between these gangs. That's the kind of light that can continue to grow now that it's been put in there. Just have to have the right person to come in and pick up the flag and move this thing forward for them.
Well, you're a light bringer in many ways. I mean, have you ever faced violence from your fellow blacks as you try to help them get away and turn their back on Democrats who want to keep them enslaved to big government policies?
No, what I face is like anybody else who stands up. Is the intimidation, the threats. But at the end of the day, there are people in this country, and what I love about patriotism, in whatever niche we're in, we feel strong enough about our families, our country, our faith to stand strong and be who we need to be. That is what's going to take. And it's, of course, we see it occasionally in very, very patriotic, very very courageous people like the Martin Luther Kings, but it's the individual people we don't really hear about on their day-to-day lives, doing the right thing, serving, standing up and saying, you know what, no, that's not right, and doing it in a respectful way that we bring our country back. It's not the big things. It's the little things on a day-to-day basis that we all do as we the people that will bring our country back. And recognizing this young man, Nipsey, is a good example of that. Black, white, it doesn't matter who we are. We recognize the impact he was going to have. We respect him, and we want to bring more people to that same point that he was.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. Burgess Owens, I want to thank you so much for your time. His latest book, Why I Stand, From Freedom to the Killing Fields of Socialism, available on Amazon.com, and we'll link that up on iSpyRadio.com as well. Burgess, thanks again.
Mark, thank you so much. Look forward to doing it again, my friend, as soon as possible.
Absolutely. When the people are united, the people win. When the people are divided, government wins. There are some big nation-altering things coming down soon. So be sure to say a prayer for our leaders, the ones trying to restore America, because as we say every week, the best information is you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.